July the 19th, July 19th, 2000. I would say the activity that I talk about, I wasn't some super agent Bond. I seem to be in a state of terror most of the time.
Could you start with where this all started? I know your teacher said you must.
My teacher was the daughter of Elizabeth. It was the sister of Elizabeth Klein. She came from the little village of Zenor being the home of Patrick Heron, who took me to the cottage in which they were born. It was the sister who recommended that I go to America with the gifts I had as a painter, because I had another idea that I could go there and become a boxer. A method of getting out of England, I didn't have any money, but I did have talents and gifts, and I was approached by a group in London who said that we need your assistance. They'd learned about the concentration camps in Europe, which was a revelation of horror to people, and they asked me to go there to see what could be salvaged, to look for athletes who could serve in the what was then Palestine but became the State of Israel. And until the age of 10 or 12, I was brought up in a home where English was not the language, and the language I spoke was a patois of German, Yiddish, Hebrew, and Cockney English. I remember once being asked by a teacher in school before a class, what is this thing? What do you call this thing? And he addressed himself to me, and I realized I didn't know what the English was for a basin, but in Yiddish it's a schüssel, and I said schüssel, you see, and I can still hear the laughter and an undercurrent of don't mess with him, he's a boxer, or his brothers are boxers, you know, but that really troubled me that I couldn't name a basin, and so I began being very concerned about speaking English correctly. I know that people might think that one fights to get out of the ghetto, but that isn't really true. The ghetto is really a nice place in which to live. You know, I still dream of the sights and sounds and the food, which is never been eclipsed by anything. The food that you enjoy that your mother made when you were a child, you can never eclipse this. There's no gourmet dish that can really satisfy you, unless you're some sort of cosmopolitan degenerate. I remember the foods. And contrary to the prevailing opinion, boxers were not necessarily people whose wish it was to fight their way out of the ghetto and earn fame that way. There was a different motivation to talented young men who had these physical gifts, namely to make it clear in the country in which we were, to which we had emigrated as the victims of pogroms and persecution in Russia and Lithuania, these countries. Family that were stained by mob violence in these countries arrive in England. There, you know, life was certainly a lot more pleasure. It's a civilized country. But then we became aware of the press and the media and our being demonized, you see. And this is where the younger people excel in sports to indicate that we don't have horns, that we suffer pain and are gallant in victory. And this was the motivation of my brothers who were boxers. But again, you had a wonderful fighter like Jackie Kidd Berg, who became a world champion. He fought in an American style. And yeah, maybe it was his wish to get out of the ghetto. Well, I don't think so. He just had this raw, wonderful talent. Ted Kidd Lewis was another world champion from the area in which I lived as a boy, the ghetto. But I remember on my honeymoon, we went down to San Francisco with my wife, and she wasn't feeling too well in the hotel room. And I went out promising to come back with some aspirins or something that somebody could... the pharmacist could recommend. I went in there and I saw a man that I last saw when I was 9 years of age. See, this is you know, over four decades ago. I was a child. You know, I remember him. And we were all at a camp in Canby Island, which is in the Thames Estuary. And these were all East End boys who came and lived within the ghetto. But his brother, was a talented composer, and the brother buried Carmen Miranda to the tune of Tico Tico, which belonged to her. It was really written by this young fellow, see, this that became her anthem. And he lived in the United States as and worked for Doris Day for many, many years. His name is Joe Lubin. And his brother was sort of his sidekick or honcho who would follow his talented brother. This is the man I ran into, his brother in San Francisco. And he said, aren't you... He said, I'm Kid Harris's brother. He said, oh, yes, I remember you, patting me on the head. And then he opined that, oh, if only he was back... in the East End, you know. And, you know, I had this vision of the fruit stands where they sell pineapple and naphtha flares, you know, the sort of unanimity of things and the comradeship, you know. And the wonderful foods, but above all, that if you did something heroic and returned to this small world, everyone admired you, everyone looked up to you. And here's this man who spent, you know, 30 or 40 years in under this penumbra of Hollywood success, you see, in the shadow of his brother, dreamt of, if only he could go back. And I thought I should tell him that all the Jews have moved out and have gone on to better things. They've left the ghetto. But it no longer, what he dreams of no longer exists. Now there's a splendiferous cultural axis of the Whitechapel Art Gallery has become something of world class. And we've been replaced by what appear to be blacks from the West Indies and so on and so forth. It is not the same. You could not take the hero's walk. Anyway, so if you had physical abilities, there things were required of you, you know, namely in boxing, even in cricket and things like that. These were important things. And then also the protection of brothers who could not defend themselves. The fellow who wrote the South American music was a skinny, weak little boy who was picked on by other people and came under the protective wing of my brother. I'm doing all sorts of things. You know, here I am, I'm started boxing when I was 8 years of age, and then I discovered this talent, which was like
for art.
For art, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I thought, no, what the hell is this? You know, why does this have to happen to me? You know, and then we're there's a period in history where we learn of dreadful things that have happened. We saw the first survivors of concentration camps arrive in England, you know, acting like animals, you know. People would fight over food, and this is in a restaurant situation. So I was with a group of people who weren't necessarily Zionists, but no one had any place to go in Europe. There's no place for Jews to go, you see. They were slaughtered by the millions, and from Poland, their homes were stolen from them. There was no place for them to go. They could not return from whence they came. And Palestine seemed to be the logical place. So I found myself involved in Zionist activities, where we would do things in establishing a flow of people. And I was also with a theatrical group doing theater sets. You know, all of these things are running along on parallel lines. And so I began to learn to speak English like an officer. And I was given a few weeks to come up with this accent. We did this by feedback. We had these old tape wire recorders, you know, so that I could go there, and in the chaos of Europe, I'd be uniformed and would find out what I could do to rescue brothers. Anyway, there was a delegation going to the British zone of Germany, and we had a young woman, a legislator named, her name was Jenny Lee, and she was the wife of Aniron Bevin, who was a politician in the House of Parliament. I think he became the foreign, no, that was Ernest Bevin, another fellow became the foreign minister. But Aniron had responsibilities under the Labour government. The people spurned Churchill at the end of the war, selected Clement Attlee in a Labour government. And anyway, Jenny Lee was on the back bench of this party, but she was placed in charge of a delegation to visit the concentration camps that we had liberated in the British zone. So I glommed onto them, and you know, I was terrified at what I was asked to do, but it seemed to go along beautifully. You know, I didn't have to fool British people, but rather Germans, who were now, we were their conquerors, and, you know, sundry other people that, you know, I could talk to in their tongue. What unfolded for me was the most horrible experience in my life, glomming onto that delegation, and we saw Bergen-Belsen, when it had been cleaned up very much. All I want to say about it is I thought there is nothing that can be salvaged from these skeletons, you see.
Living people, you mean?
Living people, yeah. Nothing could be salvaged. And I couldn't see them as soldiers who could fight or do anything or plow or till the soil. And the delegation, this is not like a junket, and people just wanted to get the hell out of there, had no business being there, you know. And Jenny Lee, MP, Member of Parliament, returned to England, as we all did, and She returned to her constituency in Wales and died within a week. They said that young Jenny Lee, she was about 32 years old, she was our glamour lady of politics, of the Labour government. She went to Bergen-Belsen and she died a week later. We had the mayor of a city nearby said he didn't know this was going on, and he returned home and died. He didn't commit suicide, but died within 2 days, you see.
The mayor of which town?
Of Bergen-Belsen,
okay.
Of Belsen, you see. So, you know, I just say that for the horror of it. I couldn't stand the smell, I couldn't stand the sight of things. I thought, my God, what am I doing here? Then I'm back in England, and my brother, I want to say quick about my brother. He he was kind of a promoter. He loved dancing and he loved dances, and dancing is a big deal in England, where as many as there are dance halls that could, where 3,000 to 5,000 people can dance, and these dance halls, like the one out at Cricklewood, has 3 floors and there are 3 orchestras, and so there's thousands of people dancing, doing the waltz or what have you. And my brother Sid got into that business, and which is going along swimmingly. He also managed the Blackbirds. The Blackbirds were Negro songsters from America. Their sound preceded the Motown. They were from the same town in Chicago, and they sang to people in England, and they were managed by my brother. So he was involved in theater, and indicated he was going to make movies and stuff like that. And he organized one dance in the county in which we lived, which had a mere 2 dance floors at the Odeon Theater. And he had 2 bands playing, you know, and on top of all this, he decided to challenge the British welterweight champion to a fight. And the fight was sanctioned. Now, he was a boxer, and why he turned to wrestling, you know, just beats the hell out of me. But it's obvious that as the evening drew on and people were going to retire to the upstairs to watch the fighting, he was drinking champagne, was drunker than a skunk. My mother was summoned to try and stop this, and but it seemed hopeless, and he climbed in the ring with the British champion, who handily defeated him, you see. His pride was such that if ever you mentioned that match, he would bristle, you see, and you'd be on bad terms with him, you see.
And that was a boxing match?
No, it was wrestling.
Oh, wrestling.
He was a boxer who decided he'd
challenge the wrestling champion.
Right, because in England they have divisions, weight divisions in wrestling. In the United States, they don't. Everyone is a version of Hulk Hogan in America. But in those days, and even now, you have the weight divisions in wrestling. And why he ever did that, well, why? But anyway, the whole spectacle was enjoyable anyway, by everyone concerned, you see. his opponent assisting him out of the ring on a stretcher was one of the choice moments of my of all of this. Anyway, he began to make films, and sought the permission of the Air Force to work at their combat airstrips. It was to be a film about the Battle of Britain or something like that. And there were glamorous-looking ladies that he had recruited from the, you know, the world of the theater and the dance halls and stuff like this. And he had cameras shooting at planes, which were kindly loaned to his production company. And but this was their plan. There were 2 great pilots in World War II. One was Sergeant Cohen, And the sergeant flew a little biplane called a Fulmar, I think that was the name of it, and it was a biplane with two wings, you know, if you can imagine such a thing, with a hull, and he would fly around Malta picking up down British or German pilots. And his biggest patron was the Canadian flyer Burling, known as Screwball to his colleagues. And Screwball Burling, the Canadian flyer, was responsible for more German pilots being shot into the sea, and with Sergeant Cohen picking them up. But they formed a team. I don't know whether Burling was Jewish or not. I don't think so. But this ace fighter offered to fight for us in what was then Palestine. And he needed a suitable craft. And we had access, we were interested in surplus, aircraft that had been surplus in Germany and France. But the plane that was the dominative plane was the Mosquito, a twin-engined, all-wooden aircraft that was very fast, and they had been developed to shoot down flying bombs, which were really they were a precursor of jet planes, of jet aircraft. And we climbed onto such a plane. We kind of sequestered it. We adorned it with glamour girls, and then Screwball turned up anonymously. And he climbed into the cockpit. His co-pilot was Sergeant Cohen, and they took off. But we preceded them on a boat. We arrived in Geneva. We went up into the hills. We had cars illumining the strip. And these two great flyers landed and crashed on landing. Why? Because we're not aircraft mechanics or anything like that. Here were a bunch of actors, but they didn't make an altitude adjustment on the plane. A simple thing like that doomed these boys when they thought they were flying at, at 400 feet. They weren't. They were flying at 6 feet above the earth because they didn't adjust that goddamn thing. I remember we used to do primitive kind of surveying with altimeters, and they were really not very precise instruments because the atmosphere would affect them. But anyway, the atmosphere killed these two boys. So I
was in Palestine.
No, this was in Italy at a secret rendezvous. This is where they died. So we split and ran in different directions. I climbed. Went aboard this Danish ship, which didn't know it. They were quite innocent of the fact that, you know, some of its crewmen were doing things like this and delivering guns and other weapons, you see.
Just a moment. Wait. You said the crash occurred in Italy. Did you run to a ship or back to a ship that you already
were on? No. They found me a job in the Danish Merchant Marine.
They?
This Zionist group. I call them a Zionist group,
And so did that start in England, or were you still in Italy?
No, this started in England. The project, the Mosquito aircraft, all of this is done in England. Then we left to rendezvous with the aircraft. Yeah. The plane with Screwball Burling in command would have cleared the skies just upon his arrival. He had a reputation that he made in the skies over the Middle East. His reputation preceded him, and it was a dreadful tragedy for all concerned. I talk about Sergeant Cohen and his diminutive rescue plane, but when the invasion of Italy was planned, in the original plan, in the invasion in World War II, when forces left North Africa to begin the invasion of Italy, they were to island hop from Sicily to Italy. But the first island they were to attack was Pantelleria. See, they felt they would have to neutralize the island of Pantelleria. Anyway, Sergeant Curry was flying around there picking up people that had been shot down by Screwball, and his engines went out on him. He had just one engine on that little biplane, and he drifted into shore, and he thought, well, hell. And so he was preparing to become a prisoner when thousands of people were on the shore, you know, the medley of people in civilian clothing and military uniforms, and a man in ceremonial garb who was obviously the mayor, and a man who was an Italian general. And they came out, he floated into shore, and they said, "We surrender." And the sergeant said, "You can't surrender to me, I'm an uncommissioned officer, you'll need..." They said, "Well, can we use your radio, because we don't want to be bombed again?" And he said, "Yes, my radio's working." So the little sergeant accepted the surrender of Pantelleria, and the attack went to Sicily under the command of Montgomery and General Patton. Anyway, I returned to the ship after that thing with Burling, and the ship was a boat picking up citrus fruits in the Middle East, and would perform this circuit. It would go to Genova, and then through the straits there. We could see Vesuvius coming down, you know, lava from Vesuvius coming into the ocean. I often wonder about that, whether that still happens. And what I remember about... where's that dog? He's... yeah. Anyway, I've never really met the captain of the ship, but one day a man walked by me on the deck, and he was dressed in a Homburg hat with a Persian lamb collar and a single-breasted suit, a pinstripe suit. I thought, my God, this must be a passenger, but I wasn't aware of any passenger. I was working as a mess boy or cabin boy. And I said to the chief steward, I said, "Who is that?" He said, "That's the captain. That's Christian C. Christensen." I've often wondered what the middle initial meant. And he said, "This is where he says hello to his girlfriend." I said, "You're kidding." Well, we met him on the port side, so we both went over to the starboard side, and we could see the captain on the very edge of the bridge of his ship, and he was waving, and on a little abutment that extended from a cliff was a lady and two little children, and they were waving to the ship, to the captain, you know. And that's the happiest thing, you know, I just couldn't believe it. And of course, we'd altered course so that she could see him and he could see her, and the children could wave and he could see them, and you know. I saw more of the captain on the Danish vessels. The ships travel with a nurse, so if you're under 16, you go ashore with a nurse. But the nurse was on leave, and also the officers, the captain, and the chief engineer travel with their wives, and the wives had just left the vessel because they'd sailed with the ship for over a year. So it's a different kind of feeling on these vessels. We had a bunch of guns, and we were told to get them ashore in Lebanon. There were to be a fellow there to meet us, and we did this. We took some crates ashore, and then the captain seemed to get wise. But we were in Turkey before we were in Beirut, and there was a suspicion that this ship was engaged in gun smuggling. And the Turks have kind of a rambunctious or a Marx Brothers, you know, the shades and declensions of Sherlock Holmes are not apparent in the Turkish character. And it was their view that everyone on the ship should be arrested and thrown in jail. The jail being one cell for 28 men, the cell being the size of this room with a toilet in the form of a hole in the corner of it. And we were detained there. Of course, to keep us all in one place was a mark of Turkish efficiency. Anyway, I was kind of worried because I was sort of, myself and my young friend Scotty, whose name will come up later, in an ill-fated boxing exercise in New Jersey, we boarded the ship, but thereafter the captain seemed very interested in us and felt that we'll have to answer questions as to whether we had, whether we were the people who had a chest of machine guns. And Scotty, who was 16 years of age, really a brilliant genius, said, we're just young fellas, you know, and all we've got to do is say, I don't know what you're talking about, Captain. I swear to God, on my dad is killed. We know nothing about them. And intelligent men are saying, but what about these crates? You had, if you got into your bunk, you climbed up three crates of Czech machine guns. Where the hell are they? Oh, Captain, you're barking up the wrong tree. I'm just a wee lad of 16 years of age. And I don't think that Alfred sleeps here like a log. He can no be any helpful to you. So, and they were very frustrated at this. You know, we're not, you know, what do? They had this sort of mock ceremony before the mast in the captain's rig salon or smoke saloon. And they just decided to leave us be and hope that we jump ship in Tel Aviv. Harking back to Turkey, where we were detained for the rest of the day and during the night, the Turkish guard, it's strange about when I think of Turkish people, they're either minuscule people who look like raisins, you know, with crinkled skin, or they're giants, gigantic people, and some of them red-haired, you see? And we had a gigantic red-haired Turk who single-handedly shoved everyone in that cell. And then he arrived in the morning. I thought, well, this is where the trouble begins. This is where they start knocking heads. And but no, he had something that was written for him, and obviously had been bribed, paid off. And all I remember of the thing that was written for him, it was an apology to us. And it began, this giant man was saying, my darlings, you see. I mean, in all seriousness, and we had to, you know, we thought, well, don't laugh, you know. And we said, we filed out past him. Each one of us said, thank you, darling. Thank you, darling. Darling. And so we all got back on the ship, and we delivered our stuff to the Arabs, who were paid to take this to our colleagues in Israel. Anyone else who thought this went differently was barking up the wrong tree. It was the ship landed. It didn't land. You were offshore from Tel Aviv. There's no harbor there. There might be one now. But the ship landed across from Jaffa. And Jaffa is the suburb of Tel Aviv. You might say that Tel Aviv is the new town and Jaffa the ancient Arab city. And I said to Scotty, I said, we're going to swim ashore, you see. Because we thought the jig was up for us over this gun-running thing. And anyway, we're kind of innocent of it. Other people saying, you know, you have a cabin and we've secured this for you. You take this stuff and our people will meet you and handle it. But we were now kind of scared about this, you see. And I remember... I said, well, what hell city is that? And it was Jaffa. We could tell because there were explosions and bombs and going on all over the place. And Tel Aviv was relatively quiet. But you could see fighting in Jaffa. And then we were boarded by Arabs. And our cargo would come from Jaffa. And these guys would come aboard the boat and boast about what they were going to do. And they would, you know, fire guns into the air and stuff like that. So we kept our mouths shut. And then we thought, we weighed the idea of swimming ashore, but we were about a mile offshore and out of artillery range of the things that were going on there. And also we saw these fish tails that looked like sharks. And we just didn't want to venture into the water. They might have been something else like tuna or marlin, I don't know, but in the... So we were... didn't escape the ship, we remained with it, and we elected to, Scotty and me, well, to jump ship in New York.
Somebody made a...
The stuff was placed in our room, and there were other people, stuff was placed in their cabins, and they were paid for this sort of thing. But,
So your job was simply to what, accompany these
things? Accompany these things, and to show people where they were, you know.
Who came on.
Who came on, yeah. Okay.
And so the crew would just turn a blind eye, maybe they were involved.
The crew would turn a blind eye, but in those days, when you visited these areas, a currency in Italy was cigarettes. If you had cigarettes, a carton of cigarettes, you could obtain a suit, custom tailored to you. Two cigarettes had a value for a mixed drink in a bar. And there are other things that are more obscene that you can get for a cigarette. That was the currency. The salary of the seaman on that boat was $60 a month. But they would come into New York, and people representing Camels and Pall Mall would come aboard the ship, and they'd spend their entire salary on the purchase of cigarettes. And so they were earning far more than that on the black market. Everyone was involved in this. Anyone who, you know, because he was drunk or sure or jailed for some other thing, would become involved in what we were involved in, but would expect money for this. And we didn't know who they were, would be paid to install the guns and stuff, you see. Like, we don't know who got us out of the jail in Turkey. We don't know. We don't know who loaded the stuff in Italy. Mm-hmm. They were Czech machine guns. They make excellent machine guns, but we don't know where the hell they came from. I suppose we had agents who were spotting, you know, when I went there, I glommed onto that delegation. There were others whose job it was to look for surplus that can be used for fighting.
And part of your idea, anyway, was to get to the United States. This is a way of...
Yeah, I thought, God, I thought I want to get out of this.
Yeah.
Out of this, you know. I think when I was five, I don't think I know, when I was 5 years of age, there was a little magazine that would come to the house, and on the back cover there was this advertisement, and it was of a boy enjoying Ovaltine. You know, an organization that begs you to become an Ovaltini, you see. And I don't know whether they had Ovaltine over here, I don't know. But, and there were radio programs for Ovaltinis. We are the happy Ovaltinis, happy girls and boys. And I used to look at this advertisement, and it's of a perfectly dressed child. And I thought, I could be like him. And at the age of five or six, I thought if I dressed and behaved and sat at the kitchen table with a glass of Ovaltine, surely I'll appear on the page of that magazine. You see, and I look at the kids' magazines that come in, and I wasn't there. You see, I never understood advertising and stuff like this. So this is a perfectly spontaneous thing, and one has to be polite and so on and so forth, and have the Ovaltine. Now, I believe this, but I think strains of this go through your life, this sort of naivete, but to have it shattered by, you know, the events that occurred, and to feel responsible for Screwball dying the way he did, and Sergeant Cohen, and then those death camps. I think for the first time with Hanging Clown is the first time I've ever been able to find some beauty in it, you know, that there is a soul and this is unconquerable. I thought, well, whether I like it or not, I'm going to the United States. And however, I had a minor problem. Because of the good food on the vessel, I came down with a bout of protein poisoning. In a country where you eat one egg a month during the war, or you can get 4 ounces of powdered egg, so on and so forth. But we didn't starve in England. There were lots of food that was unrationed, like sausages, bangers, potatoes, bread. But on the ship, my first breakfast out at sea, they brought what you'd recognize as a pizza plate, and it was full of egg sunny side up. You know, there'd be 15 or 20 eggs on a pizza plate, and I just couldn't believe it. I started, and I would eat one and eat two, and this meant nothing to the other guys. They just indicate they wanted more egg or something.
Coming, huh?
Yeah, keep them coming, you know. and so on with other food. Imagine they had a Christmas dinner at sea, and they had I never realized we had goose in England. We have turkey here, I think, or ham. The Danish have kind of a duck l'orange, you know, duck in an orange sauce, you know. I mean, imagine this on a little steamer, a little 2,400-ton little ship, you know. Anyway, when I came back to New York, my limbs had swollen up, and I looked like an elephant. I thought, oh my God, now what? Because oh God, I'm doomed. You know, to be, you know, fit or in the pink was. So there was a hospital on Staten Island, the Swedish sailors' hospital, And I went over there, and I want to share it with Scotty, and Scotty had something else in mind. And I was meeting at the Seaman's Home, which is at the tip of Manhattan. And of course, I took the ferry over to Staten Island, found the hospital, and a guy, I walked in there, he says, "Oh, you're another one. You're another one of these guys that got protein poisoning." And I didn't know what they were going to do. I thought, would I be subject to, would they cut me open to let the fat out? You know, some sort of ghastly liposuction, you know. And he filled a glass with water. And he said, "You know what this is?" I said, "No, what is it?" He said, "This is Fuller's Earth. It's from your country, you know." And he put a heaping tablespoonful of this, and it turned the water into this milky looking fluid. He said, "Drink all of that." And I drank all of that, and then all the swelling, everything went away.
Okay.
It went away, yes. Well, not within the hour. It took, I don't know, about 6 hours, but I could feel all this going away, you know, limbs.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, I had these benign growths in my body, and I thought, why don't I try the Fuller's Earth trick? So I went to these herbal companies. They never heard of it.
I've heard of it.
You have?
Oh, yeah, but I don't know what it is, but I've heard of it.
Well, if you know where to get it, I'd like to get some. And,
someplace in Britain.
Yeah.
Internet. Get Patty to look for it on the internet.
Fuller's Earth. Oh, that's a good idea. Why don't I ever think of these things? Anyway, walking towards the Seaman's Home, I felt, you know, much better. And Scotty comes running out of there. Because Scotty was always in a panic, I think. And he says, "You'd better jump ship, laddie, you know." And he was extolling America and how easy it is to get a job here. And I said, "But I don't have cards. I don't." He said, "You don't. Yeah, you didn't need cards in America. All you need is a social security card, and I'll take it to where you can get one." Now, we had been through this, I think.